السلام عليكم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله محمد.
دعيتم إلى ضيافة الله. The Holy Messenger would always say when the month of Ramadan was approaching. That is, you're being called towards Allah's invitation. During the holy month, we are Allah's guests. In the month of Ramadan, we're called, we're invited by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And like with all invitations, even in this world, although this invitation, this divine invitation, is immaterial in nature, it's an invitation for the soul to ascend closer to Allah. But even with worldly invitations, one always prepares oneself before going to the residence of the inviter, the host, for example. And one prepares oneself in different ways. With this divine immaterial invitation in the holy month, how do we prepare ourselves immaterially or spiritually? And the answer is the months of Rajab and Sha'ban. The du'as in these 2 months, especially Sha'ban, bears the most deepest of meaning, spiritual meaning, and can prepare you more than anything else for the holy month. It's interesting that the one du'a that all the imams have been recorded to have recited is the du'a of Sha'baniyyah. Why? Because of this preparation for entering the month of Ramadan, being a guest of Allah. They took it very seriously. It's the only du'a which we see that all the imams, it's recorded, that all the imams used to read to prepare themselves. And du'as are very important. Although spirituality exists in all religions have spirituality to some degree. And all these religions, they emanate from Tawheed. And the source of all religions is Tawheed. And as Allama Tabatabai said in Al-Mizan, he said, Tawheed is the father of religions. Abul Adiyan. Exact clause. Tawheed is the father of all religions. But some of its children are righteous and some of its children are non-righteous. But all religions, they emanate from Tawheed. Even if they don't know it themselves. And therefore, all religions have spirituality. However, the spirituality in Islam is not the same as the spirituality in Buddhism, Hinduism, and other faiths. And we Muslims, we shouldn't be looking elsewhere for spirituality. One or two names, I don't want to mention them on the pulpit, but they're becoming very popular amongst the youth and even amongst scholars. And they're reciting the works of these people from other religions. And it's not haram what they're doing. As I say, spirituality, you know, it exists everywhere. But Islam has a separate code of spirituality. And that code code is to be found in the du'as of the Ahlul Bayt. It's not to be found in books on Irfan or books of X, Y, faith. These are explicitly found in the du'as of the Ahlul Bayt. Anyway, this divine invitation that we're all invited to, unlike the invitation in this world that we're invited to people's homes, here, on the contrary, it's all about abandonment. Because song in essence, fasting in essence, means abandoning. And that is what Allah wants from us, as the host. He wants us, as the guest, to start the abandoning process. Now, it starts with the physical things. No eating, abandon drinking, abandon other things, the 8 or 9 things on the list that the Sharia tells you. If you do that, you grow. You acquire some metaphysical truths. Allah wants you to abandon those too. Then you acquire, get deeper, and keep on acquiring more the material truths. Allah wants you to abandon those too. You keep on abandoning them until you abandon the self. And that's the end goal. Once the self, the ego, is abandoned, at that stage you're no longer a guest. Before there was a host and a guest. Once the ego, once the self is eliminated, there's only a host now. Even the guest is not there. Because one's ego, one's self has been eliminated. That's why we see in the doors of the Ahlul Bayt, they would cry a lot. They wouldn't cry because of the sins that we do, because they wouldn't do those things. But sometimes focusing on something material, just focusing on it. Even though you're recalling Allah at the same time, but for them focusing on that, even though they're commanded to focus on it. But like this was so lonely, it was as if they committed the greatest of the great sins. Because of the level of iman they had. Anyway, the du'as are important. We have to prepare ourselves for the holy month. And the way was through the month of Rajab and Sha'ban primarily. Okay, we were speaking about food last night and how food is also a conduit to becoming closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then we ended with the tradition that the Holy Messenger said that because of not accepting the second drink, which was separate to the first drink, he said that I won't accept this second drink. Although I don't prohibit you to do it, it shows according to Sharia it's okay to have the second drink. But according to the Tariqa, no, I won't do it. But I don't prohibit you to do it. It's on a par with the letter of the law. Then he added the clause that one has to have tawadu, humility, before Allah. And then Allah will elevate that. But whoever has arrogance, Allah will depress their spiritual status. That was the tradition we ended with. Now, 1400 years ago, a misdal, an application, an example of arrogance in dining was to accept the second drink. It was a sign of arrogance. Today it may not be. Today it may have its own examples. You can think of better examples than me. But if there's a component in dining, in eating, in the food industry, that is on a par with arrogance, or it's against acquiring humility. For example, it's associated with people who are arrogant. Try and avoid those etiquettes of food and dining. But then we said that how you eat, what you eat, when you eat, all these have an effect on your soul. And so this simple etiquette of eating and drinking, if you abide by the etiquette that the soul has given you, you're building the soul at the same time. So sometimes eat collectively, not alone. Eat in small muscles. Eat slowly, not fast. Eat this, not that. All these things, you're building the soul. It's a part of wayfaring towards Allah. You're taming the animal dimension. The more the animal dimension is tamed, the more you have access to the metaphysical realms. And you get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The next issue in relation to food is the question of eating with your hands. Is this something Islamic or not? Should we eat with utensils? It's a very important discussion, very delicate. I don't want to put anyone off anything, but you have to know, is eating with the hands, what its origins are. I'm not telling you to all eat with your hands or anything. Me myself, I use utensils, I'm a hypocrite here. But it's important to appreciate the reason why Islam gave the go-ahead to eat with one's hands. Very delicate, this reason. So, in relation to the question, did Islam, is this an Islamic ruling to eat with your hands? And did Islam bring this to the people? The answer is no. People used to eat with their hands even before Islam. So it existed before. And the next question is, did Islam approve of eating? So many transactions which existed before Islam came and approved of those actions, and it continued. And in some cases it refined them or tuned them to some degree, and in some cases it all those actions are invalid. Islam, we don't accept it. With eating, people used to eat with their hands. Islam came and said you can still continue to eat with your hands. And it tuned it in a very small way. I'll explain it in a minute. We have this many things, like with slavery. Slavery existed before Islam. Then Islam came, slavery was there. And then Islam came and brought a particular protocol in relation to slavery, with the end goal that you educate and then free the slave. And that's the seal, that's the conduct of the Ahlulbayt. Those slaves, in those days, not like the modern concept of slavery that we have today and since 150 years ago. No, slavery in those days was only the prisoners of war were treated as slaves. No, it wasn't a question of race or color, that kind of thing. Prisoners of war would be kept as slaves. Then they would be educated. And then Islam brought so many mechanisms to free them, ultimately. Like the kafarat and so on and so forth. And sometimes when a female slave was educated and free, and then the former husband would want her back, the woman won't accept. Or Islam wouldn't give her back to the mushrik, non-believing husband. And now she's educated. She's a Muslim now. She doesn't even want to go back to those things. And we have these examples in history. Anyway. With another example, with alcohol existed, Islam came and got rid of it and prohibited it in a particular fashion. It all depended on the times, how Islam would treat a certain action. In relation to eating with your hands, Islam gave the go-ahead. some degree. It said don't eat with two fingers. Eat with three fingers, it's better. And that's because 1400 years ago, the aristocracy would eat with two fingers. And as the previous tradition I tried to explain, whatever is on a par with arrogance and the aristocracy is outside the norm, it's better to refrain from those actions. Because it doesn't help with your humility when you practice something which is on a par with the aristocracy. Eating is supposed to enhance your humility. Oh, that's okay. Once you associate yourself in these etiquettes with something which is specific to the aristocracy or the forces of arrogance, it's going to have an effect on your soul. And we have many examples of this. We'll find those examples later, inshallah. So here, it's not taken it's better to not eat with two. Don't say it's a vajib or a halal. It's better not to have with two fingers because of it's on a par with that. Keep with your three fingers. Okay, that's okay. The question now is, what is the rationale of eating with your fingers? How does this enhance your soul? Eating, like with sleeping, like with any other action, in the Sharia, the aim is to elevate the soul, everything. The fact that we are ignorant of it, and we look at the letter of the law, core letter of the law, that's our fault. But whatever exists in the letter of the law, it's a conduit to spiritual elevation. But we have to get to know all these reasons. Now, then, I'll come to the rationale in a minute. Then the question is, can we use utensils? The fork, the knife, the spoon? Of course you can. In Islam's always, whatever is clean, whatever is an appropriate hygiene, Islam always gives to go ahead. And the utensils are clean too, that's okay. Hands are clean too, you wash it at the end of the day. There's no problem with that. Utensils, there's no problem. I use utensils too, we use it, it's okay. My purpose here is just for you to pay attention to why eating with your hands does something which utensils can't do. That's important to appreciate. If you see your parents, your grandparents eating with their hands, no, with the wisdom behind that, which I want to open up tonight and show you. But yes, if you're doing utensil service, it's a message of there's no problem with that, and no one is going to divert you from that practice. But why is eating with your hands looked upon in a very good light in Islam? I've spoken about different aspects of food many times, but I would never mention this point. It's a point that the Sufis have in their circles. Shia Sufis or so it doesn't matter. But they have these in their circles. And these things sometimes are very difficult for the common layperson to accept when they hear these things. And therefore, that's why the Urafa, their mentors, try and tell their students, don't go and open this up to the people. The people can't take it. Here, the reason I want to shed light on this was because in some parts of the world, this came out. It shouldn't have come out. But it came out that, and there were Shias too, and it's hack. But for some reason it came out of this tariqa that the followers shouldn't use a knife and fork when they eat. And this came out, and people got scared. Who are these people? These people are a bit strange, abnormal. And for some reason, the followers didn't explain why they weren't allowed to use a fork or a knife by their mentor. But it just came out that we shouldn't use forks and knives when eating. And this has a terrible basis to it. That's what I want to open up with you. But this just came out in the public, you know. I'm the recipient of the emails. And I get the email that this person said this, and they're strange, and they're this, and they're that. And you have to explain to yourself that this confusion abates somewhat, and lessens somewhat. Otherwise, people can't take these kind of things. These things all have an Islamic basis, and they're a family basis. However, if you don't explain it, people get scared. Some part of the world, there was a mustahab custom of wearing the amama in a particular way, and people, you know, they weren't used to it. They felt a bit, you know, strange. They shouldn't have felt strange, but they did. They weren't used to such practices. But if the people were to come and explain everything, it could have lessened people's worries. The common layperson, like me and you, we're very simple when it comes to religion, and we're not ready to take the depths of religion. Our religion is something very, very superficial. And that's okay with simple people, we're not very deep. But some of us think Islam is this superficial aspect and nothing else. And that's what we're not. These people are moving towards having a Da'ishi approach to life. Anyway, so what is the reasoning behind eating with your hands, which Sheikh Tariqa was prescribing for his students, and then told them not to use the fork and the knife? I'll first give you the answer, and then I'll support it with Islamic reason. When you use a knife, you, the sword, who is using the knife, you're cutting something. And when you use a fork, you're forking something. Is it a better word? You're piercing something. With the knife, you're cutting something. With the fork, you're piercing something. With the spoon, you're scooping something. Now, if this action of cutting, this action of piercing, becomes second nature, this becomes incorporated in your soul, and then the soul becomes a cutter, a piercer. And then at the work environment, at school, with your friends, you spiritually cut them, you pierce your neighbors, you cut your neighbors, you sting them, you do haram against them. But if you use your hands, you neither cut nor pierce, and the cutting and piercing attributes don't become incorporated in the soul. You're using your fingers. Cutting doesn't qualify here. Piercing doesn't qualify here. It's much more gentle when you use your hands. Now, that's the rationale. Do we have an Islamic basis to it, to support it by? Yes. In the Sharia, it says, don't cut the bread, or don't cut meat. Now, these two, bread and meat, were the most common foods 1400 years ago. Don't cut them with a knife, with some food. Why? See? Use your hands. to break the bread or to halve the bread. Use your hands for the meat, but don't cut, don't pierce. And with your hands, you're not piercing anything, you're not cutting anything, and you won't become a piercer or a cutter. But with the knife, with the fork, yes. And then in Islam, why is being a qassab a makruh profession? Qassab doesn't mean a butcher. Qassab is one who slaughters as a profession, slaughters animals. Qassab is this part of the neck. It cuts that part of the neck. Qassab, one who slaughters. It's makruh. Why is it in Islam? Is it makruh to have that as a profession? Because if your profession is a slaughterer, that slaughtering will be incorporated in the soul, and then in society you will slaughter. If at all may say that there are some professions which are involved with dogs and everything, that's out of necessity, it's not saving someone's life. That's a good thing, that compensates. But for eating, what you do every day, here Islam prescribes eating with the hands. So don't feel that it's something abnormal, don't think it's something messy, it's good for the soul. It's interesting that in the West, they don't use a spoon. They use a knife and fork. Actually, the effect of the knife and fork is worse than the spoon. The spoon is more benign. It's more of a scooper than anything else. It's not a cutter. It's not a piercer. And therefore, there is some rational basis and Islamic basis to this. So you see, everything in Islam, it has this esoteric dimension, this botany dimension. And therefore, the Sharia has to be looked at very highly. Because this Sharia has depths, has inner meanings, inner dimensions. And this very Sharia wants to elevate the soul. But if you are of the belief that this Sharia, the letter of the law, core letter of the law and nothing else is the goal, that's a very dry viewpoint. And one will have a very dry religion. It's okay, it's acceptable. It's very dry. There's no life. One won't evolve. One won't grow. One will remain static. It's only when the soul grows that one grows. Okay. So, in summary, one, it's good to eat with your hands out. I know. Some of you already eat with your hands, continue, it's very good. Those of you like me who don't eat with their hands, at least in public, it's simply difficult. I don't want people to stop eating with their hands tomorrow and say the shakes and that. It causes problems and everything. But at least when you eat alone, have this in mind. Yes. Okay. Half an hour has passed on.
It's the weekend.
So, continuing with this aspect of food and different kinds of food, there's a verse in the Holy Quran, it's in Surah Al-Baqarah, the second chapter of the Holy Quran, from verses 57 to 61. There are two parts of it I want to recall. وَأَنْزَلْنَا عَلَيْكُمُ الْمَنَّ وَالسَّلَوَى And we brought down upon you two kinds of foods, manna and salwa. Now, I'm not 100% sure which foods they are, and scholars are a bit divided as to which foods they are. Manna, it may be a form of honey. Salwa, it may be a kind of bird, the quail, so to speak. So it's honey and a form of bird. These are two understandings which are given in some traditions and many songs. But the point is that Allah brought them down, sent these foods from high up down to the people. Kulu, eat, min tayyibat ma razaqnakum, eat of the wholesome things that we've brought, that we've provided you with, provided sustenance for you with. Wa ma zalamuna, and they have not wronged us, Allah is saying. Walakin kanu anfusahum yadlumun. Nevertheless, they only, the word only is because anfusahum has been preceded, has come in before the verb is used. It's only their souls that they are wronging. They have not wronged us at all. These people who eat. It's only their souls that they are wronging, using the imperfect tense. Now this is the context of food, I'll come to that in a minute. This is a very important formula we have in this song. And inshallah, maybe in 3 or 4 days' time, I'll open this up. But in order to open this up, the concept of Ketabarat has to be open. And unless you understand that concept, you won't understand the formula. But I just tell you what the formula is. And this is one of the verses of the Holy Quran which supports the formula. That no one can commit zulm against you. Other than you cannot commit zulm or wrongdoing against you. It's a very deep statement. It's a Quranic equation. Only you yourself can commit zulm and wrongdoing to yourself. But other than yourself, no one can commit zulm to you. And that thing that we call zulm isn't truly zulm. And that's why the concept of Iqtibarat is important to open. But have that for now, keep that in mind. And it's very important. Anyway, when you're eating, you're not wronging others. It's only your own souls that you're wronging when you eat. But as we said, if you eat fast, if you eat alone, if you eat in many, in large morsels, all these are your molding the animalistic dimension of the soul. You're becoming more animalistic. Your soul is becoming more animalistic. Your soul is being attacked because of the way you eat, what you eat, how you eat, when you eat. Your soul is suffering. Your soul is not wrong. Your soul is being wronged. Only your soul. You're not wronging anyone else but yourself. Eat of the wholesome things, Allah says. Now the story is in relation to Nabi Musa alayhi salam and Bani Israel. Food was given to them from the skies. Let's say honey and the form of bird was sent to them down from the sky. Eat this. Then in verse 61, وَإِذْ قُلْتُمْ يَا مُوسَى, recall when you said, O Moses, لَنْ نَسْبِرَ عَلَى طَعَامٍ وَاحِدٍ. Recall when you said to Nabi Musa alayhi salam, O Musa, we can never endure, we can never be patient with one kind of food. This one kind of food is coming from above. We can't endure that. Fad olana rabbak. So, Musa, call upon your Lord for us and Israel. Call upon your Lord يخرج لنا بموت بطل الأرض. To bring forth that which the earth grows. Here it begins right now. Allah gave them physical food for the physical event. At the end, I want to give you the spiritual interpretation, the esoteric botany meaning of this verse. But still, it happened. This piece of history, this thing did happen in the physical realm also. Allah sent them food from above. Downwards. They couldn't endure. They don't want that kind of fruit alone. We want the fruit which the earth grows. We want the herbs, the cucumbers, the garlic, the lentils, the onions, the things which grow from earth. Tell your Lord that feels these kind of things. Allah is giving them fruit from above. They can't endure it. These are important terms. Food from above, that's one term. Two, they can't endure it. They can't be patient with it. Two. And three, they want the things which are grown from the earth. Things which are, no, on a lowly level. فَالْأَوْلَنَا رَبَّكَ So call upon your Lord for us, Musa, do that. يُخْرِجْ شَرَامَ مَرْكُمْ بِذُلْعَرْ To bring forth at which the earth grows or is growing. Then, a few examples. مِنْ بَخْلِهَا herbs, وَقِثَّارِهَا cucumbers, وَفُومِهَا garlic, وَعَدَسِهَا lentils, وَبَسَدِهَا onions. These are the foods we have. The earthly foods. Then, Nabi Musa gave a very important equation. It's another Quranic equation. Although all the verses of the Quran, if pondered upon, every verse, important practical equations exist. She said, we're very oblivious to it. We don't pay attention. We don't want to know. Then قَالَ Musa said, أَتَسْتَبْدِلُونَ الَّذِي هُوَ أَدْنَى بِالَّذِي هُوَ خَيْرٌ Do you want to exchange that which is better for that which is lowlier, for that which is worse? Do you want to make such an exchange? So here, we look at it from a spiritual level. Allah, through different means, directly and indirectly, gives spiritual food, which is primarily knowledge, to each and every one of us. It's just that, can we endure that knowledge? Do we live a spiritual life? A life of purity, so that we can be a recipient of true divine knowledge from Allah Himself. That's true knowledge. We want to be a recipient of true knowledge, and Allah is giving us knowledge every day. But because we are captivated by the worldly life, we are shutting ourselves off. We can't endure it. And then we suffice with the worldly knowledge that we have today. By worldly knowledge, I don't just mean architecture, medicine, these are all good. I even mean seminary studies. That's also a worldly study. Only that knowledge which Allah gives you directly, whether you are literate or illiterate, you can be a recipient of that ladunni, true, divine, direct knowledge with presence, rather than acquiring knowledge through an intermediary, through a mentor, through a teacher, through a school. That's good also. But the soul may not be growing there. The soul grows with divine knowledge. Me and you today, We're saying it, whether we're saying it verbally or not. We're just like Bani Israel. We're saying, oh no, we can't endure that kind of knowledge. We'll never endure that kind of food, that divine knowledge. Give us the herbs, the cucumbers, give us X subject, Y subject. Let us be, suffice with that, suffice with that. Everyone I've seen, when they reach 80, 90, 100 years, whether they were the best doctor, the best lawyer, the best architect, they see their lives as futile. Most people. It was all void and futile. I don't believe it, you see them yourselves, the last moments, where they see the reality of the last moments. If you out with your seniors, in their last moments, be with them. When your mother, father, grandparents, they're undergoing their last moments, sit with them to the very end. Whatever they say right now, even if it sounds rubbish, because they're speaking as a result of what they're seeing in the metaphysical realm. One is who's undergoing those last moments, they're not limited to this realm anymore. The seeing has started for them. Anyway, I guess you can all avoid everything. Because there's no divine knowledge. They were never recipient of divine knowledge. They were never after divine knowledge. They would say with the same wording, we can never endure one kind of food, food from one source. When we can't endure that, we want the earthly foods. Nabi Musa says, do you want to exchange that which is better with something which is worse? And then the verse gives five foods. Cucumbers, herbs, onions, and so on and so forth, those foods have negative connotations. And in the interpretation of dreams, if these foods are seen, usually it's a negative dream, but it can be positive depending on the dream itself. I want us to be careful. Instead of being resurrected with cucumbers and onions and garlic, one wants to be resurrected with true divine knowledge. Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Ali, he had many poems, he wrote many poems, and he wouldn't publish them until after his death, then they were published. And those poems have a very profound meaning to it. In one of those poems, and a lot of the Farsi audience is very strong now with the Iranian Akhani brothers. Yeah, and actually read this part of the poem in Farsi. He said, "Anke ruh afzas, jam bade az dast negar ast. Ni mudarris, ni murabbi, ni hakim, ni khatib ast." Which means that which elevates the soul is the chalice of wine from the hands of the beloved. Actually, it's not the physical wine, it's the spiritual wine, that divine knowledge, which intoxicates you divinely. That which elevates the soul is the chalice of wine from the hands of the beloved, but you get it directly from Allah, not the teacher. Not the mentor, not the hakim, not the sage, and not the khatib, the one who speaks on the pulpit. They're just intermediaries. They're just preliminaries. We're a guest during the month of Ramadan to be recipients of this divine food. And the reason we say, again, of the month of Ramadan, we're just the same as we were in the beginning, because we never prepared ourselves and we never became a recipient of this divine food, which is the Son of Allah.